There's no use looking back, and it's no use laying blame. That's it. That's your history. You just build on your history and you move forward. And, you know, the older I get, the more I realize it's quite an amazing story.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who used to eat what was on her plate, one food at a time, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode number 76 of Running for Real. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am really happy you are here with me. I hope you enjoyed last week's episodes with one of the best leaders out there when it comes to biomechanics and running form. We were very lucky to have Dr. Rich Willey on the show. He flies all over the world to talk to other medical professionals about his research. And you can go back and listen to that one if you missed it. You can either find a link in the show notes, or you can make sure you're subscribed to Running for Real to get new episodes every week. And I would definitely recommend you go back and listen to that episode with Dr. Rich Willey if you didn't already. Now, today I have one of the role models of the running world, particularly the female running world, someone who I'm honestly a bit embarrassed to say I hadn't actually heard of until she reached out to me. But she has an amazing story, and this will really show you that even when you think the world is against you, that no one thinks you can do something big, well, you can and you will. Anne Ordain is not just admirable for her running career, but also for standing up for things she knew was right, even if that meant no one else stood with her at the time. Now, before we get to our sponsors and then on with the episode with Anne, I just wanted to let you know that I do now have a Patreon page. That's a page for supporting me and Running for Real. I'll tell you more about it after the episode as I want to get to the show, but please stick around with me to hear more. It will allow me to keep bringing you these free episodes for many years to come, and your support means so much to me. So please tune in to listen to how you can help me later on in the show. All right, let's hear from Hoka One One and Body Health and be right to Anne.
This podcast is sponsored by Hoka One One. Hoka One One is a running shoe unlike any other, and you're going to love it. If you haven't tried them yet, what are you waiting for? Run in their newest release, the Bondi 6. Run for any distance with a plush, soft ride. The Bondi 6 is the sweetest cushion.
Thank you to Body Health for sponsoring this episode of the Running for Real podcast. Perfect Amino has been supporting me and my training for years now, and I need it even more now I'm trying to get back into running. I forgot how sore you get when you start running again, but at least I now have something in my corner to help me recover. Remember, coupon code TINA10 will get you 10% off at bodyhealth.com. And thank you so much for joining me on the Running for Real podcast. I am really excited to learn from you. I know our listeners will be too. And thank you for being here today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And they'll get to listen to two British Commonwealth accents at the same time. I bet that'll be a novelty.
Yeah, I hope they enjoy that. I'm not sure how many Americans versus internationals we have, probably a lot of Americans. So they'll be loving it because, as we discussed before we began this interview, we both get asked all the time where we're from and people saying they love our accents. So hopefully everyone enjoys this. But so you just mentioned that there, you were born in New Zealand. When did you end up moving to the US and why was the decision made to come do that?
Well, I came to the United States in 1981. It was right after the 1980 boycott of the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. And I was 25 years old then, and I had already competed and qualified for 72 Olympics, the 76 Olympics, and now it was the 1980 Olympics, and they called the boycott. And at that point, I heard the rumors that the United States were going to allow women to run the longer distances finally, because that back then the 800 and the 1500 meters were the longest distances in the Olympic Games for women. And the rumors were that the United States were going to open up the road racing, the marathons, and the 5 and 10 Ks. And I just took a chance. I actually went to Madrid, Spain, and the New Zealand cross country team in March of 1981. And people there really encouraged me to come to the United States. Some of my Kiwi compatriots said, you know, you really should come. We really think that you're going to be better at those distances that you are the 800, 1500 meters. So instead of going back to New Zealand, I packed my bags and came to the United States.
Oh, you didn't even go home?
I didn't go home, no. Oh. And the rest is history. And 37 years later, here I am.
But you have been back to visit, right?
Of course, okay. Yes, of course. Because at that point, oh, that's another whole long story of immigration. But in other words, I had to keep going back to get the right visa to be able to come back and compete. So until I retired at the end of 91, I would always leave in the American winter and go back to the New Zealand summer and be with my coach and run the New Zealand track season. And then I would get the visa and I would come back to the United States in March of each year. So I did that until I retired. And about that time, I managed to get my green card and then I became a citizen in 1995.
Okay. Okay, cool. Thank you for sharing. And as I get asked this question all the time, I have to ask you as well, what are the differences now that you, I mean, I know it's been a long time since you were there, but what are the differences you see, you know, talking to people now back in New Zealand to running there and running in the US?
I think that I still like the different systems, and you can relate to this too, is New Zealand is dominantly a club system. So all sports are really administered by the clubs, mm-hmm. whereas here in the United States, it's all around the schools. And I still prefer, I get asked why I have never coached in the United States. And I say that I could never coach under the system here because I don't believe it's conducive to real success in the Americans really having a huge platform of great distance runners. They get some every now and again, but I truly think that the system in high school and college just burns so many out, mm. where the system in, and as I said, like Great Britain with the club system, where we're not under all the rules and regulations and coaching rules that they are here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And actually, I do have a daily podcast. I mean, you wouldn't know this, Anne, but many of my listeners do. And I had a question about the comparisons between US and UK. And that's one of the things I mentioned was there's a real big drop off of runners at the end of college, university, because essentially so many people are just like, you know what, I'm done. You compete pretty much every weekend for 4 to 5 years straight, and it's exhausting. So I go back and forth on which way I prefer, but when it comes to the college system, yeah, you're right that there are quite a few runners who don't make it because it's just, you know, they're just so fed up of the sport by the end of that time in the university. So thank you for sharing. Okay, let's go back to your story. You know, I'd love for you to share kind of the beginning of your journey. You know, you started running, I'm not even sure if you started running first or if you had the bone deformities and the reconstructive surgery first, but tell us about what was involved with that. What does that even mean, bone deformities in your feet?
Well, I was given up for adoption as a baby. My mom was a teenage mom. And when I started to try and walk, my parents noticed that I just didn't have the proper gait, the heel-toe motion, that I was shuffling along on the back of my heels and very pigeon-toed. I wouldn't go forward. And so they assessed me, and they just basically said that I had bone deformities up the front of my feet that was stopping my big toe from the tendons of my big toe from operating. It's kind of complicated, and they never really had a word for it. But they told my parents they weren't going to do anything until I was in my early teens so that my bones would be strong enough to heal well from the surgery. And so all through those young years, I shuffled along. I couldn't really do sport. Caused me a lot of pain. I could not wear normal shoes. My father would get kind of, I used to jokingly say, old lady slippers, and cut a hole in the side so that the protrusion stuck out. It was kind of like enormous bunions to anybody. For anyone to picture, that's what it would be called. And then in the summertime, and New Zealand's climate is pretty mild where I grew up, so I went barefoot a lot because that was the most comfortable. And then in the summertime, kind of get these sandals where my dad would cut a strap off and so that the bone would stick through. So it was kind of a tough childhood in the fact that it resulted in a lot of teasing and bullying and just being laughed at, and focused primarily on being top of the class and putting all my efforts into education. When I was 13 years old, they said, okay, we're now going to do the surgery. And they said, we can't promise miracles, but we just want her to be able to walk better. And really what was so amazing is that I got there and talked to the surgeon a few years ago. He was 88 years old at the time, and he really put it into words, which is actually in the documentary, where he actually explains it in a really funny way. And he says, because they ask him, well, did you think she was ever going to turn out to be an athlete? And he says, no. He said, we would have done the surgery on her if she'd been the biggest couch potato in the world. We were just trying to get her to walk better. So anyway, when it came time for me to leave the hospital, I was in plaster casts, and under those casts, and of course that was the days of the old plaster of Paris casts, I mean, mm-hmm. where it's all soppy water and whatever that they mold onto your feet. And I've got 64 stitches in each foot under these casts. And when it gets time to leave the hospital, they say, we've come up with an idea to help her get the heel toe motion immediately. And they created a black leather boot, and on the bottom of the black leather boot was a rocker, like a rocking horse. I never had crutches or a wheelchair. I rocked my way out of that hospital. And I started high school like that. Anybody going on my website can see my first day of high school, the only picture I allowed my mother to take of me. But you can see the rockers. And I walked around like that for the next 2 months. And what it was doing is and it was as painful as can be. And the casts had to come off and the stitches had to come out. And then they put the cast back on again. But it was genius. Even though it was hell at the time, it was genius. Because as my feet, I was forced to go forward by those rockers, which I might not have had the confidence to do if I wasn't have been forced to do it. Mm-hmm. So when the cast finally came off, my feet looked like everybody else's. And I had to go through therapy, but it was almost like it's easier to run than it is to walk. And so, like, we go back to the club system, all my schoolmates and the kids in the neighborhood all belong to the local track and field club. And so it just seemed natural. I wanted to be like everybody else. And so I want to join the track and field club. And my mum and dad just thought I was nuts. And it wasn't because I thought I could run. It's just I wanted to be like everybody else.
Yeah.
So I joined the club and just immediately found that at the club they inspired you to try everything, like the long jump, the high jump, the shot put, as well as the sprints. I was 14 years old. And with the field events, it was just like, I don't want to jump and land on my feet. I don't want to throw a shot put and land on my foot. Let's just stick to the running. And I just found I was good at it. And the system allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do. And so very quickly, I started competing against senior women in the 800 meters. And that's how my first coach saw me and started coaching me.
That's so cool. Just such a great story of, you know, we often find ourselves looking at things that, you know, we don't have or that are wrong with us, that the world is against us. But you took that and kind of said, you know what, I'm just going to, like you said, it wasn't even about proving anything at the beginning. It was just being a part of something, which is the right way to enter the sport. And then from there, you developed, you were good at it. You kind of got better and better. And, you know, we're going to go on to talk about more that you did. But do you think any of that kind of the struggles in school, you know, you mentioned being teased, bullied, and I'm sure a lot more of that went on that first year of high school when they saw you in plaster and stuff. What did that teach you? Like, was there any part of that that made you kind of tough and like resilient and able to kind of fight a bit, dig a bit deeper, I guess, when it did come to the running?
I think so. I think, first of all, being adopted. Mm-hmm. There was that element of being very independent. Then I think being so-called different also made me very independent, so that I don't need people around me, that I'm very, I don't know whether the introvert or solitary, it's not really quite the right word, because I can easily get up and give an hour's speech, and I'm not introverted in the way that, in that respect, but I'm comfortable in my own company. And I think when I started to run and train, I've always preferred to train alone. And I was really, it really helped me just sit in hotel rooms being really, really nervous and ready to compete. And I just knew how to enjoy my own company and be very independent. And I think that is there. The competitiveness, and all my fellow competitors say that I was really competitive. I'm not sure that that's really the right word. They say when they turned up to a race and I was entered, they knew they were going to be in for a hell of a time.
So like gritty.
I think that's it. It's not really, it was my whole theory. What I wanted to do as a runner was run as hard as I could myself and cross that finish line as fast as I could possibly do. And if I got beaten on the day, that was absolutely fine. As long as I ran as fast as I wanted to run. So I never ran tactically. I never let anybody else, unless they were really much better, dictate the race. So it was like I got out there, and it was that independence. It's like, I'm going to run. I know what I can do today. If you can keep up, fine. If you beat me, fine. But I want to cross the line knowing that I've done the very best. And so I think that that's where a lot of it came from.
I love that. And that's actually the same approach that I take to my races as well. And I've had people over the years say to me, well, don't you think that's not really racing then? Because you're not really like competing. And I'm like, well, if I crossed the finish line and I've given my best and I beat someone, then we competed. I just wasn't really aware of it.
But you competed against yourself, and you competed against the clock, and you're getting the best out of yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I can sit and watch track and field now and watch races and just get so frustrated for some of the athletes, because I know they're better than what their result is, because they've allowed themselves to be dictated to.
Yeah.
And you're not always going to win everything that way, but I sure won a lot that way.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go talk about that in a second. But just while we're on this note, is there anything you would say to the listeners who are, you know, maybe listening out there, they're recreational runners, you know, the competitive aspect isn't really going to be, or the competition aspect, I should say, isn't really going to be a huge part of their racing, because for them, you know, they're not trying to win any medals. But I feel like this is very relevant about doing your best and not, you know, because if you're going to finish 1,000th and 37, you know, that's one thing, but it's better for you in that situation to do, like you said, and cross the finish line as quick as you can. So what advice would you give to someone listening who's in that kind of situation, why they, just some more affirmations as to why they should try this approach?
Well, I think that they're not out there competing against anyone else but themselves and the time. And obviously if they go out and run a 5K and a 10K in a certain time, then they question themselves, do you want to improve, or are you quite happy with that time every time you go out? Then if you really want to see improvement, then I would say, well, go find yourself advice, go find yourself a coach and start monitoring your improvement. And then that's the self-satisfaction about seeing self-improvement, which is only what I'm doing too at the higher level. Is I want to run faster in every 5K I go, or every 10K and whatever, or every different race that I go and run, I want to come back the next year and see if I can run faster. So it's all relative. It's just that I run faster than the average person, but it's actually no different in the self-satisfaction. Yeah. If you're happy where you are, you're happy where you are. If you want to improve, go find the ways to improve.
Love that. Thank you. That's really good advice there. And just to kind of wrap up with the issues that you had growing up, you know, was there any period of time during your running career where the fact you were adopted, or the struggles you went through when you were young, through the bone deformities and just other things, did that ever stop you, or did it ever kind of go into your mind of like giving you, I guess, an excuse when the going kind of got tough? Did you ever allow it to kind of beat you down a little bit, or were you always kind of determined that you were going to succeed despite what you'd been through?
Yeah, I think I was always determined. I never looked back. I mean, I've said, you know, a lot of speeches and everything, is there's no use looking back, and it's no use laying blame, and it's no use, you know, you've just, that's it. That's your history. And it's you just build on your history and you move forward. And, you know, the older I get, the more I realize it's quite an amazing story. So I did handle it in the right way. And there was no blame. I found my birth parents at the age of 32, and they were married. They got married a year after giving me up for adoption. And so I have six younger full brothers and sisters. And it was the greatest gift I ever gave them was finding them. And they had followed me as an athlete in New Zealand, but they had no idea that I was the oldest sibling. And so I always had a positive thing about that. I loved my parents, my adopted parents.
So they didn't know that was you? They didn't know you were their daughter, but they knew you just because you were a good runner?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
By the time I found them, I was a household name in New Zealand.
That's amazing. What did they say when they did find out? Yeah.
That's another whole long story. But no, I had great parents and they encouraged me. My dad was really just special. And even though I couldn't do sports as a youngster, he educated me on sport. He taught me about horse racing. He took me to cricket and rugby matches. And it was like he raised a daughter to really love sport who couldn't participate in sport at the time. But by the time I did get to participate in sport, I knew everything that it needed to be an athlete because he'd really got me to participate as a watcher, an observer.
Yeah, that's great. And by the sounds of it, it wasn't so much like, you know, you started to run and your parents were like, you need to do this and you need to train like that. They just kind of allowed you to kind of run as you wanted, and you just happened to continue to improve and do it your own way. Is that right?
Yeah. Both of them were very nervous for me. They thought at first that I was really making a mistake of running on those new feet, as they called it. But as they, you know, with the doctor's support and the therapists and everything, and the beauty of New Zealand was that so many of our tracks were grass tracks that I could go barefoot for a long time before I had to start racing on the cinder tracks and wear shoes. So they got to see that, first of all, I'd fallen in love with something. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it looked like I was pretty good at it. And at that point, they were just all in.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And then one more thing before we move on to kind of what you've done since then. Have you ever spoken to a doctor or anyone like that in the recent years to ask them what they thought of kind of you said it was genius what they did to kind of heal your feet. Have you ever spoken to anyone just now to see like what their thoughts were?
Well, here in the States, anytime I get an orthopedic surgeon, I tell them my story, and I would say 95% of the time they would say that American doctors would not have done that, would not have let me. They wouldn't do it now. They would not let somebody leave the hospital in that case. That they just wouldn't do it. They were astounded, and they still are, that I was allowed to walk around like that with those boots, and that almost immediately.
And were they astounded that it worked?
Yeah, they are. And but I also think they think maybe it's just a one-off situation, and it worked out just fine. And, you know, with the medical system here, you know, they'd probably be scared they'd be sued as well, whereas New Zealand, you don't have that. So those doctors took a risk, and it paid off. And actually, that head surgeon, the one that I got to talk to when he was 88, he actually got to be world renowned because of a lot of techniques that he invented in New Zealand in orthopedic surgery. And he got to speak all around the world on his methods. And he carried a scrapbook of me. And when he spoke, he would always tell my story. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. All right. So you went on to do some incredible things in your running, qualifying for six Olympic Games, 1972 to 1992.
And from what I read on your bio, it says in every distance from the 800 to the marathon, which shows incredible range. So tell us about some of your Olympic experiences. You did mention 1980 being a boycott year, but you know, how did that feel having that long of a career when now, you know, people are celebrated for qualifying for maybe two or three, because it's quite unheard of that people are able to kind of continue doing that year after year.
Well, I think that the blessing that those of us, the women of that era had, was that the long distances were not there. Going back to my comments about sport in college and high school here now, those distances, the 5,000, the 10,000 meters, were not there for someone like me at that age. So I started off running the 800 and 1,500 meters. 1972 Olympics were the first Olympic Games that added the 1,500 meters. And that's the distance I qualified in, and I was only 16 years old. And they chose me in the team, but with 3 weeks to go, they said they weren't going to take me because New Zealand can't financially field a full team in any sport. And so they thought I was too young to go, and so they pulled me from the team. And that was pretty disappointing because obviously that's a dream, but also I was only 16 years old. And with the Munich Olympic Games, with the massacre of the Israeli athletes, with the terrorists getting into the Olympic Village, the New Zealand team was housed on the same floor as the Israeli athletes, and a lot of the New Zealand team witnessed a lot of stuff that went on. And so, you know, I look back at that and say, you know what, at 16 years of age, if I'd seen anything like that or experienced it, I probably never would have left New Zealand again, or my parents wouldn't have let me leave New Zealand again. So I didn't go. Then in 1976, I'm a new elementary school teacher. I'm 20 years old, and I win the national championships in 800 and 1500 meters and get chosen to go to the Montreal Olympic Games in 76. And I mean, I've run 2 minutes and 4 seconds for the 800 meters and 4 minutes and 11 seconds for the 1500 meters, and I'm 20 years old. So the whole country, I'm now getting a name in my country. I'm multiple national champion. Got my little class of kids at the elementary school. So I go away and everybody thinks that, oh, I'm going to come back with a medal. And, you know, people from New Zealand, they don't understand how big the Olympics are. Yeah. And, you know, whatever, 167 countries and there's 3 rounds to get yourself into the final. So I lined up in the 800 meters and I ran my best time and I finished last in the first heat. And so, you know, there's nowhere else to go. So I just wanted to get on a plane and go back to New Zealand. And manager says, no, you've got another race to run. So I lined up for the 1500 meters and I ran a New Zealand record. I ran my best time and I didn't finish last, but I only finished eighth. And that wasn't good enough to go any further either. Mm-hmm. So I've gone to the Olympic Games at the age of 20 and I've run my best times, but I haven't even got past the first heats. Well, of course, if you go back, 76 was the era of all the Eastern Bloc cheats, the drug cheats, and before the wall came down. So I watched athletes that I didn't even thought looked female just run amazing times, and it was a little discouraging. But I remembered being out on a warm-up track and a Russian coach coming up to me and saying, you're very young. You come to Russia, we make you much better.
Oh, my God.
I was like, uh-oh. So I went back to New Zealand and I had to really, because, you know, there was no money. I was a school teacher. I was getting up and training in the morning, teaching all day and training in the afternoon. It was my job. So I had to make a decision as well. What am I going to do? I'm not really good on the world stage, although I had finished ninth in the world cross country 3 times by then. I finished ninth in the world cross country when I was 17 years of age in 1973. So I had traveled and run cross country. I knew that the sport was a great way to travel for free. So that was my decision to keep going, was that, well, I want to make some more teams so I can travel more. So I did through 76 to 80. I made Commonwealth Games teams, more cross-country teams, World Track Championship teams, and then 80 comes along and I qualify for 80 and the boycott happens. And so that brought me to the United States. And then you fast forward to 84 and I ran the first Olympic women's marathon because they didn't put the 5 and 10 into the Olympic Games in 84. So I So that's when I held the world record in the 5,000 meters and I was number 2 in the world in the 10,000 meters, but they weren't added to the Olympic Games in 1984. So I chose to run the marathon and that didn't end up too well because I was such a novice. I made the team. I ran the fastest debut marathon to qualify, faster than Greta Waitz ran her fastest debut marathon. So I ran 2 hours 32.05, I think it was, for my debut marathon and qualified for Los Angeles. But then the New Zealand Federation, because they had some other really good female marathon runners like Alison Rowe and Lorraine Moller and Mary O'Connor, who had also already qualified, even though two of them had not run faster than me, they said that I was the novice, so I had to go prove myself and run another marathon in March of 1984, which actually happened to be the Los Angeles Marathon on the Olympic course in March of 84, to prove that I should be in the team. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I got chosen. But by that point, it's March, and you got to turn around and run another marathon in July. So by the time I got to Los Angeles, I got to 22 miles in sixth place, and I ended up in hospital on an IV with dehydration.
Oh, no.
So then fast forward to 88, and they put the 10,000 meters in for the first time, and I finished 10th in the final. And then I qualified for the 10 and the marathon in Barcelona in 1992, but I decided that was it, and I retired at the end of 91.
So, well, pretty amazing.
So ungrateful I didn't go to the Olympic Games that I could have gone to.
No.
Very, very ungrateful of me.
I think you achieved so much, and I haven't even mentioned a lot of the there's more coming from what you've done that we're going to talk about in a minute. But with that Olympic kind of journey, you know, the Olympics ends up being the pinnacle of people's career, you know, the thing that people work for above all else. Would you have changed anything going back, or do you feel like it just kind of, you know, your journey unfolded the way it was supposed to?
Well, like I say, I don't go back, but my husband keeps saying to me that I and my coach made the wrong decision with Los Angeles, that the 3,000 meters was put in and 2 years prior is when I'd got the gold medal in the 3,000 meters in the Commonwealth Games in Brisbane. Mm. And the British girl I beat, Wendy Sly, or Wendy Smith, as she was then, got the silver in Los Angeles in the 3,000 meters. And so, you know, hindsight, well, you should have stayed at that distance. I actually disagree because I was on a road racing circuit now, and it was very difficult to – I pulled it off at the Commonwealth Games in 82 by combining road racing and track, but it was very difficult to do. I would have had to just give up everything here on the road racing circuit, which was how I was earning my living. Mm-hmm. Because being on a visa to run here, I couldn't get any other job in the United States except to run. So that was how I was earning my living now. And so it was the right decision because, as many will remember, Zola Budd from South Africa and Mary Decker Slaney from the United States got in a battle and Mary fell because they were all fighting for the front. Well, with me, with my way I like to run, I could have been the third person in the mess.
Yeah.
So I don't think it would have been a good decision, but everybody else does, but I don't.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you for sharing that, you know, kind of in a glance into what's going on behind the scenes of wondering about your career. Now, you mentioned about making money and, you know, you were the first professional female runner, but your journey wasn't always smooth, which is what people often think that it is for professional athletes. But when you first accepted that prize money, when you became a professional athlete, you were given a temporary lifetime ban. Did you know that, did they like threaten that they were going to give you a ban, or, you know, was it something that you had no idea was coming? You know, how did it feel when that happened?
Well, I'd arrived in the States in March of 81 and heard that this race was going to take place in Portland, Oregon in June of 81, and it was going to be sponsored by Nike, and Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, was going to put up the prize money, which was going to be $50,000 equally split between the first 10 women and first 10 men. Mm-hmm. So it was $10,000 first prize for a 15K. And so when the time came for that race, they encouraged everybody to come. And in my mind, I thought, this is it. You know, I had traveled in Europe and watched my male compatriots get under the table money for racing in Europe, and yet women got nothing. If we got a plane ticket or a train ticket, we were lucky to get on the circuit. But I watched them earn a lot of money in Europe because they were very good. They were world record holders and Olympic medalists, but it was all under the table. So I thought, this is my chance to earn my living. So I had no hesitation about making the stand. And I was 25 years old, but I had no hesitation about that stand. So I went for this race, and the night before, they got gathered us all in a room with all the athletes and the coaches and all the people who thought they were now going to be sports agents. and they laid it out to us that if we accepted, in fact, they made us sign a document to say that if we were in the top 10, would we or wouldn't we accept the prize money the next day? So I signed and said, yes, I would. Now, I knew the consequences, that it was a lifetime ban for being a professional, for accepting any money in our sport.
Was that men and women or just women?
Oh, yes, men and women. It's a lifetime ban. The sport was amateur. The Olympics were amateur. There was no such thing as the American basketball dream team. It was not allowed. They were all college players that were playing in the Olympic Games. So I knew that was the penalty. But what I had faith in is that there were enough people, well, put it this way, I didn't think Phil Knight was stupid enough to be doing something that would destroy a sport that he wanted to make money out of. Mm-hmm. So I looked at that kind of leadership and the leadership of some of the other people in the room, and I put my trust in them. I also didn't think that I was going to win. I thought if I got fourth or fifth, I'd earn enough money to stay in the United States a little bit longer because I was running out of my savings. So, but I ended up winning. And as soon as I crossed the finish line, yes, I knew that I was going to be banned, but the telegram was practically already coming from the New Zealand Federation immediately to say I was banned, that I'd just gone and done something very, very bad, and you are done. Well, the second thing was I was only here on a visitor's visa. It's absolutely illegal to accept any money on a visitor's visa. Mm-hmm. So I was now in trouble immigration-wise. So I had to hire an immigration lawyer to get that all sorted out. I'm banned. So I've already been running on the circuit. So does this mean that I'm not going to be able to run any more races in the United States? I'm going to be deported? What was so amazing, and this is the trust I put in these people, is that there were many road race directors in the United States that were so sick and tired of paying appearance fees and to athletes that were turning up under name only and not performing, that they wanted the sport to go open and that the athletes would race hard for prize money. So they were all in. They ignored my ban and invited me to come and run at their races for the rest of the year. Now, the other crazy thing about professionalism back then was that if any other athletes lined up in a race with a professional athlete in running, they were also penalized. Oh. That was the crazy rule. Well, all the masses didn't care, but there were a lot of elite athletes that just were so mad at me because they wanted to run these races, and they were so scared if they ran against me, they would also be banned for racing against a professional.
Were you the only one who had signed yes?
I was the only top female that had signed yes.
Okay.
There were a few of the men that had signed yes. There were some that had signed, some of the females that had signed yes, thinking they were going to win or finish first, second, and third, and when they didn't, they backed out. There were two New Zealand athletes that finished second and third. One was Alison Rowe, who had just won the Boston Marathon, She backed out. Lorraine Moller, temporarily, who finished second, also from New Zealand, she put her money into an escrow account so that she didn't touch it. So they were playing games. Everyone was playing games. I cashed mine. I needed the money. So I'm not sure what I know that the American athletes, they only got suspended because of the Constitution. They didn't get banned. So they only got suspension, so they were still able to run. But there were still a whole bunch of foreigners that were scared about running against me mm-hmm. because they might get banned by their federation. Sounds very confusing, but I raced for the rest of that year, and then I got told I had to leave the United States, and go back down to New Zealand and go to the American embassy and plead my case to get the right visa to be able to come back and race again. So I went back, trained through the New Zealand summer. I was still a banned athlete, so the New Zealand Federation didn't even want me to attend a New Zealand track meet as a spectator.
Wow.
That's how nasty they were. So it was, you know, one of those times, you know, you do something that changes your life, but going through it is uh-huh. not easy.
And would you say that, you know, that whole situation made you kind of dig your heels in, that you wanted to do what you could to make a change for the future? Or was a part of you tempted to be like, oh, have I done the right thing? Should I just have, you know, kind of carried on like everyone else?
No, I was right. You know, if you saw all my scrapbooks, and I got great support from a whole bunch of fellow runners in New Zealand. A lot of other sports people in New Zealand, the New Zealand media were very supportive. Here in the United States, really the hard road came with U.S. Track and Field, which back then was TAC, the Athletic Congress, before it changed to U.S. Track and Field. They were the ones that made it really hard. They didn't want us to be professional at all. They want us to stay amateur. So it took a while for the system to work out, and they tried to get everybody, or they did set it up where everybody had to put their money into a special account in Boulder, Colorado, where they could only withdraw the money for training expenses. So they had to put in for expenses to get their own money out of that mm-hmm. bank account. I never put mine in there. Never. It's like, no, Rebel. this is my money mm-hmm. and I need it, and you're not getting it.
Wow.
And they never came at me, because at that point I was now suddenly a huge success on the circuit. They couldn't, and I was now had my Nike contract, and they didn't dare come at me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing, and thank you for being someone who did, you know, stand your ground and do the thing that you needed to do, because I'm sure you were a part in things changing. So thank you for your contribution to us.
Thank you.
Okay. And then, so, you know, the original thing I was talking about was not always smooth. You did also quit the sport for a little while. Tell us about why that was, how long it was, and why you decided to come back.
Well, I got married to my first husband in 1978. My first coach was actually a British runner called Gordon Puri, who was an Olympic medalist who had immigrated to New Zealand and was coaching at the track and field club that I joined when I was young. And he had a big group of runners that he was coaching, but Gordon's temperament was all about him, and it was I don't know, maybe people in the United States would understand the basketball coach Bobby Knight and his temperament towards his players, how it was hard, and yell at you and call your names and tell you you're useless, and that was Gordon's personality. To be honest, I thrived under it. Because it was almost, I'll tell you, I'll show you, and so I actually reacted positively. But he destroyed so many young athletes in New Zealand because of that, where they just left him because they just couldn't take it anymore. Now, when I got married, I joined him in 1970 when I joined the club, was part of the big group, and I obviously had success under him by going to the World Cross Country and those Olympic Games. But when I got married in 78, it was like he clashed with my first husband temperamentally. It was almost like I became the pawn in the middle.
Yeah.
And so I went off the beaten tracks. My ex-husband, he drank and he was into, he just didn't lead a good lifestyle. So that I got dragged into that. Gordon saw that. So that became contentious. And so I wasn't running as well. And then I got knocked off the road by a car when I was training in a park, and I badly sprained my right ankle. And at that point, it was just, oh, this is just hard. I'm just going to quit. Now, that was in 1978 because it prevented me from going to the 78 Commonwealth Games in Edmonton, Canada. But anyway, I started up again. And
how long did you stop for?
Oh, only to get the ankle to heal. But it stopped me at that point going to the Commonwealth Games. So I took the time to let it heal and then just started up slowly again. So then it was coming into, I made the World Cup track and field in 79. I made a cross-country team in 79. So, you know, I got back and made New Zealand teams. Well, then 1980's coming along. And Gordon says, if you want to be really good, you're going to have to quit working. You're going to have to quit teaching. And my ex-husband, to his credit, said, okay, for a certain amount of months going into the Olympics or to qualify, let's just, you know, quit your teaching job and we'll make it. Well, we couldn't make it. So I actually went and got a job, part-time job, cooking pancakes in a pancake parlor and trying to run. And so it comes to the time where I qualify and to go to Moscow. And Gordon comes up. He always went back to Europe through the track season. So he says, why don't you come with me? Why don't you, you know, come and I'll get you into some races in Europe and we'll get you ready for Moscow. And so my ex-husband was fine with that and we could afford it. And the New Zealand Federation put up some money for me to be able to do that too. So I joined Gordon, first of all, in Norway. And I don't know what had happened to him, but he had gone nuts. And he had managed to find a cabin in the woods out of Oslo, Norway, mm-hmm. that he was using from another young runner, his family that he was coaching in Norway. And he took away my passport and my money, and he wouldn't let me contact my family in New Zealand. And it just got really abusive, not physically, but mentally abusive. And finally, I escaped one day through the forest and went to this house and called New Zealand and my husband. And it just like, he's nuts. You know, I don't know what to do. And my ex kind of go, well, hang in there. You know, you've only got a little bit. What, you know, it's like, hang in there. Like, okay. So the next thing, Gordon decided that we didn't have enough money. So he got me a job driving cars off a Japanese ship in Oslo Harbor dressed as a guy. Imagine that. Oh my God. And I couldn't, you know, he would just say that I couldn't speak English. So I would drive these Japanese cars off boats to earn extra money. So I'm trying to run through all of this too. So the boycott happens, and so now there's going to be this. I've got the time frame a little wrong, but it really doesn't matter because the gist of it is. So the boycott happens, and so then they create this World Championship 3,000 meters that's going to happen in Holland, and so I run the qualifying time to go to that race in Holland for the inaugural women's 3,000 meter championship. And then I was planning to go back to New Zealand because the boycott was happening. And so I go there, and Gordon's just getting worse and worse, and I am in terrible, terrible shape. And I finish last in the race, and I'm really distressed and physically as well. And it was just the lowest point, I think, of my life, to be honest. And I just packed up, and we went to Amsterdam Airport, and he was going on to London to visit family, and he stood there and he says, oh, well, I'll see you when I'm back in New Zealand. And I go, no, you won't. And I never spoke to him again. Wow. Went back to New Zealand, and I was really down and out of shape, and I quit the sport. And this is now maybe August of 1980. And quit the sport, just was really down. Gordon tried to stalk me, so that came to my ex having to threaten him. Mm. It was just really, really bad. And so I quit, and that was it. And then there was one day I thought, well, heck, you know, I should at least keep running for my fitness, if nothing else, because I was getting so out of shape. I was running around a park and I just thought, you know, this is so sad because I really have got talent.
Yeah.
Totally. I wonder what I should do. And I was really close to my ex-mother-in-law, and I told her, and I said, you know, there's got to be a way. And she said to me, have you ever tried asking John Davies to coach you? Now, John Davies was born in Wales and was also an Olympic medalist for New Zealand in the 1964 Tokyo Olympics in the 1500 meters. And he'd actually coached some of my female competitors in New Zealand. So he knew me very well, mm-hmm. and he knew my talent, obviously. So I called him up and asked if he would take me on. And he says, well, I've watched you for a long time, but he said, you're really coming with a lot of baggage. You are really talented. Let me think about it. Well, he took a while and he said, yes. And so I, came to train with him. And that's when my first husband was an issue too. And I was still married to him. And that's when he kind of said to me, it was almost like, well, you know, I'll coach you, but let's just leave him on the sidelines. You know, there's like, if you want to train with me, it's you and me. Mm-hmm. And I don't want any interference. So I started training with him. And immediately, once again, badly sprained my right ankle on a grass track, which put me out for a couple of months. And I'm like, this just is awful. It's like, I just cannot make this work. And he was just so patient. And I started back up, I think, in January of 1981, started running again, the ankles healed. And he was always into, you got to have a goal. My first coach, you never had a goal. It was just, you run hard. If you make it, you make it. And if you don't, you don't. There was no plan. There was never a plan. I'd turn up to training every day. I never knew what I was going to do. John had to have plans, had to have a goal so that he could map it out for me and write it down for me. What a concept. So he says, well, Annie, I know you're out of shape, but there's another world cross country team coming up to go to Madrid, Spain in March of 81. I think you can make it. I go, you're kidding. You're kidding. He goes, no, we got the plan. I think you can make it. I followed his plan. I got into that team in the sixth place by 2 seconds.
Wow.
I was overweight. These other girls were like, oh, no, she's made the team. Look at the shape she's in. But there I go to Madrid, Spain. I run really well. And I come to the United States.
Yeah.
I finished third in my first road race, and the rest is history.
Yeah, well, let's talk about those road races. So, you know, you won over 75 races in 1980, more than any other runner, which is very impressive. So just to kind of wrap up here, what would you tell listeners to know and remember when they're racing on the road, you know, just because you are so experienced, because you have done so well in those road races, what would be your final piece of advice to listeners?
Well, I think that the thing is consistency is that John made me very consistent. And I'll go back to the fact that we had a plan. We would sit down every January. We would look at the races I was going to run. We would go back to the same races that I'd raced before because I was familiar with the courses. I set it up with Nike that if I was a repeat winner, I got more bonuses. If I broke course records, I got more bonuses. So I'd actually put myself out there to make more money by being consistent and going back to the same races where I was familiar year in, year out. And we sat down in January and we had the plan. We never diverted from our racing plan each year, no matter how much appearance money I was being offered to go elsewhere. And I think that was it. It kept me healthy. It kept me consistent. And it made me a lot of money because I performed.
Yeah. Well, and I think that can be applied to listeners as well, because even if you are, you know, not at the level that Anne is, you can still, you know, take that yourself. Like, let's say someone says, oh, I've got a bib, you know, would you like to take it for me? But you've got your plan and this is kind of diverting away from it. Maybe it's not a good idea. Yes, it would be great to do another race, but what matters more to you? So I think your advice can be applied at all levels as well.
Okay, so just to wrap up here, you know, you do have a documentary which you've mentioned, Running Her Way, and you do have a book called Uncommon Heart. So I will put links in the show notes for listeners to find out more if they are interested in those. But we're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, and we will be back with the Running For Real 4. This podcast is sponsored by Hoka One One. Hoka One One is a running shoe unlike any other. Run in their newest release, the Bondi 6. It is a running shoe with a marshmallow soft cushion and marshmallow lightweight. In the 6th edition, the Bondi has refined Metarocker technology to give you a smoother, more balanced ride. It is shockingly lightweight for how much cushion it packs, and the Bondi 6 will give you maximum comfort in every mile. I know you think it's too late to start thinking about a new shoe for your upcoming races this season, but actually it isn't. I wore my Hoka One Ones for an hour the first time I put them on, and they felt great. The Bondi was one of the first shoes Hoka created, and it's become a fan favorite for good reason. Just try it on today and experience the sweetest cushion. Get yours today by visiting hokaoneone.com/runningforreal with the number 4. And use promo code RUNNINGFORREAL, again with the number 4, for free expedited shipping and become part of the family. It's time to fly. By now, you've heard me talking about how much I love Body Health Perfect Amino for recovery. But did you know that if you try it and don't like it, you can get your money back? 100% of it. That's how confident they are in what they are making and how much it will help you to recover. And hopefully by now, you know how much I appreciate it. Especially as I'm trying to get back to running after having a baby, and let's just say things break down a little bit easier than they did before, so I definitely need them to help me stay healthy. Perfect Amino is made of the 8 essential amino acids our bodies need them to function, and this will help it kind of work as it should be. And as a vegan-sourced, non-GMO, gluten-free, soy and dairy-free product, you don't have to worry about food allergies affecting your ability to recover. So with marathon season fast approaching, give yourself the best chance of getting to that start line healthy as those intense workouts and accumulated miles begin to take their toll. Remember, you can use coupon code TINA10 to get 10% off at bodyhealth.com. What do you have to lose? All right, and just 4 more questions for you. Starting with, I've changed my question recently to become, tell us about a photo that is either on social media or maybe someone took of you during your running days that doesn't quite show the full picture. So maybe in the photo you're smiling, but really, you know, you were having a miserable day. They just happened to catch you when you were smiling or something. Is there a photo you can think of that shows it wasn't quite as it seemed?
The picture I'm choosing is actually the feature photo on my website, and it's crossing the finish line with the gold medal in Brisbane, Australia. The look on my face is, you know, it's obviously, yes, I'm winning, but there's more to the emotion of that moment where I throw my hands up, my head goes back. In my mind, it was just like, thank God I finally got here. I finally did what I was meant to do. Mm-hmm. It actually makes me emotional to talk about it now because that was the first New Zealand woman to ever win a gold medal on the track, and to this day I still am. Mm-hmm. And I'm still the last New Zealander to hold a world record. Yeah. It took 13 years from me having my feet constructed to win that gold medal, and all the ups and downs in between, changing coaches and moving to America. But the funny story behind it that people don't realize, and you can watch it. People can go in on YouTube and just Google Anne Ordain Commonwealth Gold Brisbane 1982, and the whole race is on there. You'll see that I lead it from start to finish. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're on the warm-up track, my coach, who knows that I'm in really good shape, but I'm only ranked 9th in the Commonwealth. I've got 9 others faster than me, backtracks on me and is so nervous, he makes me promise that because it's a windy day, I'll never lead the race. Promise me you won't lead the race. And I go, okay, John, I promise. He goes, you're in really good shape. You can probably outkick everybody. So I go out onto the track, and the 3,000 meters lines up on the bend on the 200 meters. You have to draw a card as to what position you are on that curve. And I drew number 1, which means I'm on the pole, which is the most dangerous position to be in because everyone else is going to run fast And if you get knocked off the track, you're the one disqualified. So I take off as fast as I can to protect myself, and I end up in front. And he's commentating for New Zealand television, and I'm coming around in front of him on the home straight, and I'm thinking, oh, Lord, he's probably having heart failure. I'm out in front. So I actually pull back to see if someone will go past me, and they don't. So I keep on going, and I try again. They don't go past me because I have a reputation of being a front runner, so no one's going to go past me. And at that point, I just put the medal down, and I just went for it. And I led from start to finish. And so to go across that line, knowing I went against everything my coach had said, I did it. I led from start to finish. I broke the Commonwealth record, New Zealand record. And it was the culmination of 13 years from my feet all the way through. I finally did it. And so it's that feeling that when you see it's not just winning the gold medal, it's 13 years of work all behind it.
Yep. Oh, I hear you. My listeners probably recognize some of the words you're saying with one of my goals that I achieved a few years ago. Okay. What about a running for real moment, a moment that only runners will understand?
I think it's now, to be honest. It's now. I mean, I'm almost 63 years of age. My feet are still good. To me, being able to get out every day, it's still what I love to do. It's the only thing I love to do. I don't want to get on a bike. I don't want to get in a swimming pool. It's my meditation. It's my solitary time. I don't wear headphones. I don't listen. I just go out and look at the neighborhoods and listen to the birds. And I'm grateful that I can still do that. That to me is real life, that I'm still doing what I love to do. It's certainly much slower than it used to be, but it's keeping me healthy. It's quality of life for me now, and that running after 50 years since having my feet fixed, that I can still do it, I am so grateful to that. I mean, that to me now is, have got this far when so many of my contemporaries can't run anymore, is like, this is it. Every day to get out and still be able to do it, that's what's real to me.
So cool. Thank you so much for sharing. And a high moment, is that the one you just talked about, or is it something else?
No, I think that's it. I've had, you know, so many moments. The world record was certainly a high moment because I did it as a banned athlete. So they told me that they were never going to allow me to have it because I was a banned athlete. And once I was reinstated 6 months later, I finally got the world record plaque. Mm. The really cool thing about that was that my parents were actually there to see me do it, because once I left New Zealand in 1981, they never ever saw all these moments of all these races in the United States. They never saw me race. And in fact, my coach never saw me race. They only ever saw, he saw the live one commentated, the gold medal, and everyone saw the world record in New Zealand, but no one else was ever here with me. And so to see, after all those years, to see my dad, mum and dad at the stands, to watch me break a world record was really special. Yeah. And then to see them able to watch the gold medal live on TV in New Zealand was really neat, because after that it was all road racing. But, well, I got the silver in Edinburgh in the Commonwealth Games there in the 10,000 metres, but none of them ever saw anything live after that world record.
Absolutely. I can see why that's special, though. And then finally, what do you tell yourself on the start line of a race?
I think everything's just a blur. I think it's all before the start line, to be honest. It's the imaging the days before, where you just image the course, you picture the course, you picture your mile splits, you picture your lap splits. This is, you know, being a front runner, that's what you do, because you're not going to rely on anybody else. You have to visualize what your splits are going to be. You visualize the course. If there's a hill, that mile split's going to be slower. Each lap, if it's windy. So you visualize. I've done it all before I get on the line, so that all I want to do is for that gun to go off so I can put it all into action. So I think it's all done. And I do say this, the more nervous I was, the better I ran.
Really? Mm-hmm. So would you say something to yourself like, you've got to do this, like something kind of to make yourself nervous?
No, I just think it was just, this is what I want to do. And the more I wanted it, the more nervous I was. And to be honest, the reason I retired at age 36 when I was still winning is because I'd lost that nervousness. And with the loss of the nervousness came the loss of the focus. And with the loss of the focus, I was starting to cut corners.
Well, thank you for being honest and sharing. That is truly running for real. So I appreciate that. And thank you so much for all your answers here. So, Anne, how can people find out more about you if they want to follow along in the future?
Well, I'm on Facebook, so everyone's welcome to certainly friend me on Facebook, and they'll have to bear with seeing my pussycats every now and again. But I actually just put up historic photos, and if I see some really nice historic stuff in the sport, or if I'm, you know, just I've got a huge memorabilia, scrapbooks and photograph albums, and it's just got to the point now where it's great to share that. And then my website, I don't communicate through my website, except you can email me through my website. My book is there and the film is there. And the film is actually, it's not a how-to run or a diet or anything like that. It truly just tells my story from being adopted to the gold medal.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. Yeah. Well, I hope people will take a listen and let us know what you think. Well, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your story, for being an ambassador of the sport and you know, inspiring so many of us. Thank you so much for everything you have done and for giving us your time today. I truly appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Tina. It's been a pleasure.
It's a shame Anne isn't mentioned more as one of the pivotal players of the past. Maybe she is and I've just been completely oblivious. But I can see how she inspired change, and she's inspired me all these years later to go after my dreams completely fearlessly. Now, I mentioned to you that I have a Patreon page, and if you do not know what that is, people like me who provide helpful information like this podcast, the Daily Tina for Real podcast, a weekly blog post, an email every week with a challenge for you, all the responses I send to your emails individually, all of those things don't cost you a penny. But they do take time to create, and I do take my time that is very limited with a baby to do that. So by visiting my Patreon and by giving a small amount each month, even the price of just a Frappuccino at Starbucks, you're helping me to allow me to keep doing this, to keep giving you the support and guidance that you need as a runner and as a friend. You can find out more about Patreon to learn what it is and find out more about what I am offering at patreon.com/runningforreal. That's the number 4. That's patreon.com/runningforreal. And don't worry, it is safe to do this. You can check out the website to find out more, and I really appreciate it. You can find links to that and everything else we talked about today in the show notes at tinamuir.com/episode76. And for those of you who do after today or have in the past signed up to support me through Patreon, just want to say thank you so much from the absolute bottom of my heart. It means so much and you're really, really helping me. Now, next week we have international fashion model and founder of Day One, Candice Huffin. Candice will be here to tell us about her new line of running clothes that created for women larger than, well, tiny. Her sizes go from 0 all the way up to 32. And it's not just for women. The clothing line may be just for women, but we also had a good chat about expectations, about body image. And I asked her all about how she was treated as a quote unquote plus size model in the fashion industry. You don't want to miss out on that one. Make sure you tune in next week to find out. Until then, have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.